commentary.ca. I am joined now by Senator Hugh Siegel, who joins me to talk about his new book, The Long Road Back, The Conservative Journey, 1993 to 2006. With a clear eye, the Conservative Party insider, who was Chief of Staff to Brian Mulroney and Associate Secretary of the Cabinet in the Ontario government, chronicles the decade and more where the Conservative movement wallowed in the wilderness of irrelevance and factionalism. He notes the mistakes, missteps, and miscues and offers his hope for the road ahead. Senator Hugh Siegel was sworn into the Canadian Senate in September 2005. He is a member of the Order of Canada and a senior fellow at the Queen's School of Public Policy. He is a former president of the Institute for Research and Public Policy in Montreal and is the author of numerous books on politics and public policy. His memoir, No Surrender, was a national bestseller, and The Long Road Back retails for $34.95 and is published by HarperCollins. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program Hugh Siegel. Good morning, Senator Siegel.
Good morning, Joe.
Thank you for joining us. I mean, there's a number of books this season about what you're writing about the Conservative Party and Stephen Harper's rise to power. You focus on the 13 years that the party was factionalized. What your insider's view, I guess, is unique amongst the other books, correct?
Well, what I try to do in the book is talk about the forces at play, which you don't actually see in the newspaper reports or the speeches that were made, the behind-the-scenes forces that connected with the neoconservatives in the United States, connected with the British conservatives, connected with prairie populism and the whole Diefenbaker role on the prairies, how all those forces came to bear in the collapse of the campaign that was run by Mrs. Campbell, why that collapse was so bad. I talk about some of the things which only an insider would have seen in terms of the 1988 election on free trade, which was a victory for the conservatives, but where part of the difficulty that manifested itself in 1993 became apparent. And I think that is a unique perspective, which I thought Canadians had the right to see and understand so they could better understand today's Conservative Party by understanding the forces that had brought the reform and the bloc into being and how they had conspired to keep the Conservative cause basically divided and irrelevant for the better part of a decade.
Senator, do you think that the conservatism we see in Canada is different than that seen in the United States or even in Britain under Mrs. Thatcher?
Yes, it's very different. The conservatism that we have in Canada really goes back to Benjamin Disraeli in the United Kingdom, who was elected as a young man, and he was a one-nation Tory, they used to call him, and his notion of one nation was uniting the rich and the poor, finding a way to deal with those who were left behind in British society, and making the case that you could never have a unified Great Britain unless those who were disadvantaged to no fault of their own were given a helping hand. That's the Sir John A. Macdonald tradition, that's the Diefenbaker tradition, that's the tradition of Tories like Duff Roblin in Manitoba. That's the tradition that really made a great difference, and it's very different from the neoconservative Republican tradition, or even for that matter, the neoconservative approach that Mrs. Thatcher took. She had many compelling strengths, did a good job on many, many fronts, but that's a different tradition from the Canadian conservative tradition with which we did things like build the railway and launch so many of the programs that were so fundamental to our quality of life here in Canada.
Are you saying then, Senator, that the Christian right, for example, or extremists of that nature, they don't have a home in the Conservative Party?
The contrary. I think that if you look at the prairie roots of the Conservative Party, people like John Diefenbaker and others, they were never very far from the evangelical Christian right. And I think the evangelical Christian right, evangelical Christians have every right to play an active and determined role in our national politics. And I think they're welcome in the Conservative Party. They strengthen the Conservative Party. But I don't think that any group, whether they're evangelicals or others, have the right to win every argument. Sometimes you win arguments, sometimes you lose, but you certainly have the right to be there. And there's a lot of our history in the prairies, which is very much about the evangelical right and the Mennonites and many others who were very caring and compassionate, and for whom their faith was a large part of their life and their politics. Look, Tommy Douglas in the NDP was a very strong Baptist minister. Stanley Knowles in Manitoba was a person who was very much associated with the United Church. So that Christian presence is a positive part of our national politics, certainly a positive part the Conservative Party, and it should be, but it need not necessarily be one that always dominates on every issue. So, for example, when Mr. Harper made the decision at the first policy conference of the new Conservative Party in March of 2005 that abortion would not be in any way, shape, or form in our platform, he was clearly sending a signal that we were going to be a secular party where these matters of conscience would be open for individuals to vote on and express their own private views, but the party itself would not impose views on any Canadian. And that is very much in the Canadian conservative tradition.
Senator, you said something quite provocative, that people in this part of the country where the Reform Party was extremely popular may take exception to, and that is that you said that the Reform Party and the Bloc conspired to keep conservatives out of power in these 13 years that the Liberals ruled. Some people in this part of the country in the West, in Vancouver and in British Columbia, Alberta, they really did believe in the Reform Party. Are you saying then that they don't have a place within the new Conservative Party, that their place
No, quite the contrary. What I talk about in the book is how all of us who were part of the old party, the pre-93 party, we all have a responsibility for what happened in 93. We all have to accept our share of the responsibility. And people like myself, who I was not an early adapter, Joe, with respect to the parties coming back together. I was someone who was quite opposed to many of the things that I thought Mr. Manning was for back then. And I give great credit to people like Stephen Harper and Peter McKay, who both had roots, in Mr. McKay's case on the conservative side, and Mr. Harper's case with the early start of the Reform Party, that they decided that really the divorce had gone on long enough that whatever the disputes and the arguments and the bitterness that had existed, it was time to look beyond that, put the children first, and establish some kind of reconciliation. And so I think that the Reform tradition, which is really part of a prairie populist tradition that is responsibly suspicious of central government, that wants more local control, has a stronger view of the private sector, I think is not only welcome in the Conservative Party of Canada, but an important part of what makes us a viable national nation, just as the more traditional progressive conservative view is an important part of the new conservative family. So what tore us apart was I think, a sense that the Mulroney government had become too focused on Quebec, that on issues, for example, like the CF-18 contract, which the people in Winnipeg won fair and square, but it ended up going to Quebec anyway, that sort of stuff was very divisive. And I think that's where some of the seeds of the problem were sown. And when we came back together again under Harper and McKay, it's because a younger generation of leadership had the good sense to say, let's not focus on the things that divide us. Let's focus on the things that unite us. And that's when we were able to once again offer Canadians a meaningful option, which we had not done for the previous decade.
But you do blame Preston Manning for, or do you blame Preston Manning for the Liberals being in power for so long?
Well, I actually take the position that Preston has some of the blame, but so does Joe Clark, and so do people like myself who weren't prepared to see the big picture, the need to put the new party together so we could offer an option. All of us who resisted that have to accept our fair share of the blame. Mr. Manning, to be fair to Mr. Manning, he did do the Think Big campaign. The Alliance was an effort to try and pull people in, but the truth is the voters in Eastern Canada never really, beyond the Manitoba-Ontario border, gave Mr. Manning very much support. In fact, it was the first leader of the Alliance to actually get any support, meaningful support, in Central Canada was Stockwell Day, although even though he was a treasurer from Alberta and an MP from Kelowna, the truth of the matter is that he got a three-seat breakthrough in the province of Ontario, which had eluded Preston Manning up to that point in the Alliance's history.
Someone that appears in your book and is fascinating, that I wonder what his role was these past 13 years, and I wonder if he accepts any responsibility or of the breakup, because he was the last successful conservative leader, and that's Brian Mulroney.
Well, I doubt that he accepts any responsibility. I think he would be of the view that on the day when the government was transferred from him to Kim Campbell after she had won the leadership She was at about 47% in the polls, and she was the most popular prime minister in Canadian history. And I think his conclusion would be that what happened thereafter really is no fault of his. My conclusion is that some of the seeds of the difficulties we faced were because the GST was massively unpopular, were because the free trade agreement never had majority support across the country. Now, I'm of the view that it would have been impossible for any one of his successors, Kim Campbell or Jean Charest, for example, to have won that subsequent election. I don't think, however, that we would have had to lose as badly as we did with two seats. I think a competent campaign in 93 might have seen us come back with 40 or 50 seats, which would have changed the face of history. And I think part of why we lost so badly was because Kim Campbell didn't have a lot of experience, didn't know the party very well, and when things got really, really tough, it became quite problematic, and we lost many more seats than we had to. But no, I doubt that he would accept any responsibility, but I think all of us have to accept our share of responsibility, as I think history will suggest he has to as well. And I say this as a great admirer of his and somebody who was honored to be on his staff, but all of us who worked in the previous administration, I think, have to accept our share of the responsibility, and I talk about that at some length in the book.
Joe Clark probably will take exception to your opinion of him that he was aloof, directionless. I mean, he may think that he actually saved the Conservatives in those lean years of the 1990s. Do you think he did more detriment to the party than perhaps he would think he did?
Yeah, I don't know. I think the conclusion that I reach in the book is that there's no question that his stature and the quality of his performance in the debate for the 2000 general election saved the party's official status. But I do make the point that despite all that, the previous 5 years of leadership was such that by the end of his term in office, the party was basically without money and deep in debt. It had not launched any new policies in the previous years. Its membership was way down. So it didn't leave Peter MacKay with many choices when he finally got the call from Stephen Harper about trying to find a way to put the two parties together into a new Conservative Party. So I make the point that I did run against Mr. Clark for the leadership so that people should look at my judgment and assess it on that basis and be realistic about that, as I try to be, and I give him credit where I can, but I think it's also important that when you have that five-year period without agenda and without direction and without any real policy process, and when the new people came in from the Reform Party, Chuck Strahl and others, to join with the Conservatives, and there wasn't a way to keep that whole, that all of the folks associated with that have to take some responsibility for that. And I think the only way the Conservative Party of today can be strong is if we're honest about the weaknesses and the mistakes that were made collectively in the past. If we pretend nobody was responsible for anything going wrong, then that's the best possible way to ensure that we make the same mistakes again, which I don't think is in the Conservative Party's interest.
In that race that you ran against Joe Clark in 1998, you also ran against David Orchard. And
yes.
It seemed to me that the party couldn't define itself. It couldn't. It seemed to me it was going through an identity crisis. People like David Orchard, have they a home in the Conservative Party now?
No. David Orchard was never a Conservative. David Orchard was a kind of agrarian, small-L liberal socialist. And he was able to penetrate the Conservative Party and do as well as he did because the party was pretty weak. His people worked very, very hard, to their credit, and that's what democracy is about. If you show up, politics is about showing up. And they showed up in great numbers. But he wanted to undo the free trade agreement. He basically wanted to almost take Canada to a neutral status with respect to the United States and our alliance relationships. He only wanted our forces only involved in peacekeeping and never involved in any alliance activities as we were in the Gulf War and elsewhere. So he had a view which was quite isolationist, and that was not the Conservative Party that I was running to lead. Mr. Clark was running to lead in 98, and it was not the Conservative Party that we have now and not the Conservative Party that Mr. MacKay was running to lead. So in that context, I don't think Mr. Orchard was ever really a Conservative in the modern sense of the word.
Mr. MacKay, when he won the leadership of the alliance, made a deal with David Orchard so that he could win that race. Was the merger a hard sell for Peter MacKay? How did he come around to wanting to join?
Well, let me say two things. Peter, of course, won the leadership of the Progressive Conservatives, and when he did that, he did have an agreement, I think, signed on a napkin with respect to no merger. In reality, there was not a merger of two political parties. What there was the end of two legacy parties, the end of the Alliance and the end of the Progressive Conservatives, and the creation of a new body, the National Conservative Party, the Conservative Party of Canada, with a new board of directors and a new constitution and a new fundraising organization, which was an amalgam of the best of the two other organizations. So, strictly speaking, there wasn't a merger between Party A and Party B or a takeover between Party B and Party A. There was the creation of a new party based on the remnants of the other two political parties. So I think Mr. McKay would argue, and I think he has, that he didn't violate his agreement. And I think Mr. Orchard determined that the new Conservative Party was not a place that he felt comfortable, and I think one hears now of him thinking about running as a Liberal candidate in the coming election. So clearly I think that's where he's now headed.
When you saw Stephen Harper as a from the early days of the Reform Party, and when he was head of the National Citizens Coalition, did you think that this was the person that could bring the two, that could help bring the two parties together, and let alone be Prime Minister one day?
I'm not sure that occurred to me, but I met him when he was on the board of the Institute for Research and Public Policy, and in fact, I reported to that board, and that was a board, by the way, that had some very interesting people on it, people like Barbara McDougall and Pierre-Marc Johnson from Quebec, and people like John Helliwell, the distinguished economist in British Columbia, and people like Bob Ray, in fact, from Ontario. So it was quite a diverse organization, and I had a strong sense when I met Mr. Harper in that context that even though he and I would not have disagreed on everything, he was very fair and very respectful of different opinions. He was a person who tried to pull people together. He was a person who tried to find ways for folks to cooperate around what they did agree on. And I saw him then someone who could make a really substantial contribution to getting the parties together. I didn't necessarily think he would run for leader, but when he did, I thought it made a lot of sense. Although I did not support him for leader, I supported Tony Clement, who was the former Ontario Health Minister who was a candidate for that race.
Now, he has suggested, since coming to office in January, that there will be reforms to the august body with which you belong, the Senate. Do you go along with some of those reforms, and what are they?
I support that very much. In 1998, when I ran against Mr. Clark, I proposed an elected Senate. And the way I proposed that we do that was not through constitutional change, because I didn't think we'd ever get the seven provinces and the 50% of the population necessary under the amending formula, but rather to go to a process by which there'd be informal referenda in the provinces where there were vacancies. So when you go to vote, Joe, you would be voting for your local MP, and then that you'd be presented with another referendum ballot that said there are three BC vacancies, and you now have the right to say which one of the following 10 nominated candidates you'd like to see fill those vacancies. You'd make your X next to the three names that you choose, and then the Prime Minister of the day would only appoint to the Senate people from the list that the public had already approved. And while that would be a conventional change as opposed to a constitutional change, large parts of our democratic system are based on convention. There's nothing in our Constitution about political parties, for example. They're all there by convention. And once one Prime Minister studiously only appointed people who were chosen by the public in that way, it would be almost impossible for any other Prime Minister to roll back the clock and go back to the old system. So I support that. I was on the committee that supported the Prime Minister's reduction of the term from to the age of 75 to a maximum of 10 years for appointments to the Senate and election to the Senate, and I think that's a good idea, and I think we are making steady progress. And I've always said to the Prime Minister, and I said it to him when he was leader of the opposition, and I was appointed after all by Prime Minister Martin as a Conservative, I said to the Prime Minister, if there's an agreement between the provinces and Ottawa, and we need to open up some vacancies, and you want people like myself to step aside, I'd be delighted to do so. I had a private and academic life for 55 years before I got into the Senate, so the notion that I might leave in the public interest at some point doesn't trouble me at all.
It has been a long road from 1993 to today. What do you suggest for the road ahead so that the path will probably be a lot better than what's been?
The first thing I would suggest is humility. Mr. Harper got elected because he respected the voters in the election of 2005-06. He put thoughtful ideas around, health care, around tax reduction, around toughening up on crime before the public in a coherent way. His candidates did an outstanding job, and as long as the government continues to do that, I think they have a very real chance of getting a renewed mandate whenever the next election is. But any time a government of any political affiliation does a transfer from humility to hubris, where they think they have all the answers, and they know what's right, and no one else does, not the provinces, not the private sector, not the trade unions, not the rank and file, that's when governments get themselves into very, very serious difficulty. And I'm hopeful that the present Conservative government, which I'm honored to support, doesn't make that same mistake as has happened in the past.
Senator, thanks so much for joining us, and continued good luck with this book. It is a delightful read, and one that I enjoyed.
Joe, thank you very much, and I appreciate the chance to talk about it with you, and all the very best to you and your many readers and listeners.
The book is called The Long Road Back, The Conservative Journey, 1993 to 2006, $34.95 from HarperCollins. I'm Joseph Plenum.